Welcome to Communication First's latest community building event. My name is Bree Mercier, and I'm the Communications Director of Communication First. Communication First is the only disability-led organization dedicated to protecting and advancing the rights and interests of the estimated 5 million people in the United States who cannot rely on speech alone to be heard and understood. I am a white woman in her 30s who has shoulder-length brown hair. I'm wearing a gray sweater, and I have a screen behind me in the Communication First green color with our logo on it. My pronouns are she and her. Today's webinar will include both American Sign Language interpretation as well as live real-time captioning. You can turn on the captioning at the bottom of your screen. To view the captions in a separate window, you can click on the stream text link in the chat. I am delighted to welcome you here on the day after the 33rd anniversary of the closure of Forest Haven, DC's former institution for people with developmental and intellectual disabilities. I'd like to thank you all for being part of this important conversation among our own Bob Williams, Ricardo Thornton, Donna Thornton, and Rebecca Salon. There has been a lot of excitement about their chat. Attendees are here with Communication First from at least 28 different US states. If you are new to Communication First, we encourage you to visit communicationfirst.org, where you can explore our many resources, sign up for our newsletter, and link to our social media accounts. We have a packed program today, and the panelists have agreed to answer a few new questions as time allows. In case you have a burning question that you didn't previously submit, please write it in the Q&A box. Please do not write it in the Zoom chat. If you would like to ask a question in ASL, feel free to also let us know that in the chat, and we can put you on screen to ask your question. Otherwise, we ask you to avoid using the chat box unless you have a technical issue or request, in which case, direct that to the hosts and we will assist you. The recording of this webinar will be available in a few weeks once we've had time to produce a version with corrected open captions as well as a transcript. We'll notify those of you who registered when that is ready. Before I introduce the CS Heroes film, Communication First would like to thank School Talk, Humanities DC, and the District of Columbia Developmental Disabilities Council for making the creation of English and Spanish caption versions of this film possible. Big thanks as well to today's language access providers, captioner Michelle, and our ASL interpreters, Cheryl and Sylvie. The CS Heroes series, when complete, will have about a dozen short films featuring members of our diverse community of people with speech disabilities. The goal of the series is to elevate the humanity and diversity of AAC users, or people who need and use augmentative and alternative communication. The film we are about to screen is the third film in the CS Heroes series. Communication First created this and the other CS Heroes films because we believe in the power of disabled people sharing their life experiences in their own words. Bob Williams, the main subject of the film, sees storytelling as, quote, one of the most vital sources of peer support and community building. The film is open captioned but not audio described, so I will briefly describe it now. Throughout the film are clips of Bob being interviewed at his home, plus photos from Bob's life and snapshots of other disabled individuals whose stories are connected to his. In one section of the film, there are photos of the interior and exterior of Forest Haven. After the intro slide, CS Heroes Bob Williams, the film's chapter slides appear in the following order. Communication journey, childhood, family, and education, career, closing Forest Haven, and communication is a human right. The film will play for just under 14 minutes, and then we will proceed to the rest of the program.
Hi. I am Bob Williams. Welcome to What? Home. And why? Life. Hi, I am Bob Williams. Welcome to my home and my life. I am who I love and the work I do. Today I live in Southwest DC with my wife, Helen. We met at work and have been married 30 years. I helped raise her daughter and got two grandkids as part of the bargain. I refer to myself and others as having little to no understandable speech. It is wordy but accurate. I have had cerebral palsy all my life. I am in a power wheelchair and use a speech generating device. I can access words in two ways, one by spelling and the other by stringing these symbols together. It is an icon-based language called word strategy that was developed in the 80s, and it is going extinct. There are huge barriers and discrimination that prevent many and I believe most from accessing the communication tools they need. It is often seen as a luxury and toy. It is a necessity just like this wheelchair is, which is why it must come to be recognized and afforded as a right. I was born in the late 1950s at a time when hundreds of thousands and more baby boomers like me were institutionalized by their parents, told by doctors and others to commit their sons and daughters, walk out, and never look back. They were denied an education and worse. I experienced then and continue to routinely experience disability bias and discrimination, but I have always escaped the most hideous forms and consequences of it. Through the love and hard work of my parents, brothers and sisters, teachers, myself and others, as well as privilege and sheer luck, I escaped all of it. My parents raised me in the same rough and tumble world of love as my four older brothers and sisters. At 6 or 7, I learned to type on an IBM electric typewriter. Absent this, my life would be far different. Later, when I was around 13, my camp counselor painted the alphabet in bold black capital letters on a piece of wood. I pointed to the letters to spell out words and sentences. A year or two later, I started using a green board with letters, numbers, words, and phrases. It was called the Hall Row Communication Board, named after a writer with cerebral palsy who helped design it in the 1920s. It was so simple, yet transformative. That board saw me through high school, college, and my first two full-time jobs. When I was very young, I spent a few years going in and out of what was then called a hospital for crippled children, where I was operated on, received therapy, and went to school. Town officials told my parents it would pay for me to receive a couple of hours of tutoring, but it would never permit me to go to the same school my siblings attended. My parents, B and Bill Williams, who grew up as orphans during the Great Depression, would have none of it, so they packed up the five of us, left the house my dad built, and moved us clear across the state just to give me a fair shot at getting an education. For the first few years, I was bounced around from one school to another, along with 4 to 7 other disabled kids who were consigned to what was called the special class. We became good friends. I and my parents pestered school officials and others to finally so-called mainstream me into all regular classes from 8th to 12th grade. And, as a teenager, I hung out with disabled young people slightly older than me. Life was far from perfect, accessible, or easy, but we did a lot together. Some of us also helped to create a statewide coalition of people with disabilities in Connecticut. I later got my degree at George Washington University. That time was one of the best in my life. I had a blast going to classes, living with friends, getting involved on campus, and interning in the Senate. doing the same things those around me did, feeling and knowing others felt I belonged. My career is hard to encapsulate. I would just say I have tried to advance the rights, opportunities, and supports for children, working age persons and older adults with significant disabilities over 40 years by creating community living services in D.C., helping to pass the Americans with Disabilities Act, also known as the ADA, and administering the federally funded Developmental Disabilities and Independent Living Networks. It is a mouthful and I am proud of it. The first time I saw the insides of an institution was in 1979. That summer I interned with a lawyer who was suing the state of Connecticut to move people out of the so-called Mansfield Training School. The very place my parents were told to put me and drive away. I wanted to flee as I entered its wards, but I was awestruck by the people lying on steel gray mats on the floor because in their eyes I saw a mirrored image of what my life could have been. Soon after I returned to GW that fall, a friend took me to Forest Haven, the District of Columbia Institution for People with Actual and Alleged Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities. I say this because over the years many were sent there with little to no reason. Soon I was named to a community advisory committee to oversee its closing based on a class action brought by Harold and Betty Evans and several other black parents whose sons and daughters lived there. After college I went to work at the DCR. I was part of its team that was charged with monitoring and reporting back to the court on living conditions at Forest Haven and how the district was making progress in moving people into homes and apartments. In doing this, I came to know Viola Washington, one of the greatest teachers I have ever had. She and I worked to get a communication system that would work for her. Sadly, like many others, however, Viola died without getting the support she needed to effectively communicate. It is among my greatest regrets and is vital to what drives me. Since I first monitored Forest Haven in the 80s, I have done extensive research to piece together and tell the story of why the place came to be, and most importantly to bring the stories of the children and adults who lived there to the light of day. Their stories serve as a powerful affirmation of just how resilient and resistant people must be to escape injustice and the enormous debt we owe to them for doing so. It is imperative we learn this history, both to disrupt its corrosive effects and learn about and honor what those who were once exiled there do every day to reclaim and take charge of their lives. Since the 70s, I have tried to advance the rights, opportunities, and supports for children, working age persons and older adults with significant disabilities. I have been everything from being an intern on the Hill to an advisor to Donna Shalala, when she was the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and to Judy Heumann, when she headed the D.C. Department on Disability Services. I loved it all, and I view co-founding and leading Communication First as the capstone of my life and career. It is work I must do. Months before the pandemic hit, we created Communication First, the only national human and civil rights organization led by and to advance the rights of the estimated 5 million in the United States who cannot rely on speech alone to be understood. Instead, we must rely on multiple means of augmentative and alternative communication, or AAC for short. We work to ensure every child, woman, and man who needs AAC have the tools and support they need to effectively communicate. The promise of the ADA is that we will live as equals in our community. But community is far more than a location, it is a way of life. A way of being able to communicate, connect, and find a shared sense of respect, understanding, and belonging. This video is a series of snapshots of not just my life but the lives of others with significant disabilities and the times in which we have found ourselves in, as well as how we have helped shape them for the better. And that, as Dr. King said, continue to be caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. Beginning in the late 70s, I joined with many in enabling people who both the federal government and district exiled to Forest Haven, a warehouse for those long stamped as, quote, the feeble-minded menace, to begin new lives. What I learned from the people I came to know and love, there are the best and worst sides of humanity. The strength and beauty of resilience and dignity despite all odds. And the constancy and compounding effects of systemic racism, ableism, speechism, and hate. We at Communication First do our work because we know that the vast majority of the children, youth, women, and men who need to use the same array of tools and support I use to express myself and live life are still being denied effective access to them. And consequently denied a good education, institutionalized and isolated in our community, and worse. People of color who need these tools are among the most likely to be denied them. Why is this still happening in 2024? It is still happening because the same deep bigotry and oppression still soils much of our society, public policy, and, frankly, our humanity. Communication First works to eradicate this base injustice, and we welcome all others to join us in doing so.
As you witnessed in the film, one of the ways Bob communicates is with a text-to-speech generating device. For today's discussion, he has prepared some thoughts in advance to save time. Now, I am honored to introduce my colleague Bob Williams, the pioneering disability leader, co-founder and policy director of Communication First, and a mentor who so many of us are lucky to know. I'll turn it over to Bob, who will introduce his fellow panelists and kick off our discussion. Bob?
And
good afternoon. It is great to see those of you who are viewing us. The film we just saw covers many parts of my life and the work I do. But it is not merely about me. It is a series of snapshots of my life, and those of many with significant disabilities, and the times in which we have found ourselves. How we have shaped them, what we have learned from one another, how our lives are intertwined, what we mean to each other. And why our life stories matter. I am deeply honored and thrilled to be joined by three friends who I have known and worked with since the 1980s, over 40 years ago. Here with me this afternoon are Donna and Ricardo Thornton, as well as Rebecca Salon. I will introduce Rebecca slightly later. She is going to help Martha rate. But she is not going to get away that easily. I also have a thing or two to ask her. For starters, though, let me begin with the obvious. As I say in the film, I escaped the most vile forms of ableism that Donna, Ricardo, and hundreds of thousands of baby boomers with disabilities endured. Institutionalization, barred from school, and worse. I am proud to have played a small role in the passage of the ADA and the like. But all that pales in comparison with how, by putting their lives on the line and revealing the hideous injustice of it, impelled action to write it. This is why I believe it is so important and powerful that we share and honor our history and stories with one another, especially the stories of those who most would not ever know or know the name of. So, Ricardo, say a bit about what it was like to grow up with Erline, William, Donna, and others at Forest Haven.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And
Got excited about the video.
yeah.
Yes, I performed resident at Forest Haven. It was like I went there through a court system process and decision was already made. All I had to do was get on a bus and go traveling down the road. Not sure where I was going to be going, but it was a sign that said DC Children's Center. Then the sign changes again and again. But when I got there, I got to meet people in a big cottage, and that was going to be my home for the rest, really, of my life. My life. And I was hoping that wasn't going to happen, but that's what happened. I wound up living there. I stayed there. I had no decisions to make. I had no, and had none of that. All I had to do was follow the rules and would get in trouble. I had met my brother, William, who was very outgoing, very wonderful person, but he had a hard time trying to accept me as his brother. I met my sister, Earlene. Earlene was a beautiful person. She was my oldest sister, and she was proud to hear that she had a brother down there. And she was very excited about that. She really wanted to do a lot of fun stuff. Fun stuff like we had family that come out to visit us, and they would go down on this big field here and they have a feast and we eat and celebrate. And I was at the point where I had no idea who these people really was in my life. So it took time for me to get adjusted to who they were in my life, because I lived my life in the institution. So it was kind of hard to get adjusted, but Erling was not ashamed to be adjusted to me. We did a lot of fun stuff. Unfortunately, Erling had her good days. She had her bad days. She had days where I knew that she was really looking for something really to do and be excited about. And there were some days I felt sorry trying to figure out why she was looking so like a zombie, over-medicated to control her behavior, hurt me. And I was prompt hoping that that would not happen, but it happened not just to her, but quite a few people. Erling passed out there, and there was no thing that I could do to fix that. But I did promise her before she left that I will advocate for change, that no one else would have to ever live in an institution and suffer like that. And I met my wife, Donna.
Yeah, right.
Donna, will you share the story about your swing at Forest Haven and what it meant to you to go there?
What's your swing?
Yes. I used to be down there in Forest Haven, and I used to be, I had, they had a swing down in Forest Haven, and I used to go down there in ball field by the school, and I used to go down there by the grave and swing down there. And I used to look down there by the grave, and I always swing on the swing. And I used to always ask myself, I said, wow. I always ask my God, I always say, when are we going to ever, ever get out of this institution? And I always say, you know, I want to get out and make myself a home for myself. I want to get married, and I want to have children, and I want a house, and I want everybody to get out of this institution, because I think of like but I don't want this, or we don't want this no more. And, you know, I figure like, hey, it's time to close this institution and get out and make it a living for ourselves. Yeah. That's what I want on this swing. On this swing. Yeah.
Ricardo, talk about how we started working together.
We got out the institution. Everybody was excited.
Yeah.
We were like, we're leaving. We're finally going to be free. Yeah. Can't wait, you know. All the joy, happiness come out of it. But we came into the community, we found out that the community.
It wasn't easy. It wasn't easy.
We didn't get the welcome we thought we were gonna get, but we had got wind up going back into like we're going backwards a step.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I did enjoy was I got appointed to serve on the mayor's committee. Mm-hmm. Mary and Barry appointed me to serve on the institutionalization of the closing of Forest Haven.
Yeah.
And on that committee, I met Bob, and I met some of the other family members, Betty and Harold. And all of us that were on there, were this families, there were advocates, there were lawyers, there was attorneys, there were providers. And this committee was about trying to make a difference in the community. Our goal set was to get everybody out of Forest Haven into the community to live a conductable life, respectful life, and not look back at what they have lived. Because where we were living at first was not conductable. It was not respectful. I enjoy serving.
Yeah. Ricardo, did you want to ask Bob about what his impressions were of being at Forest Haven?
Yes. So Bob, so let me ask a question. I like this. So Bob, I can ask you a question about what you think about going out to Forest Haven for the first time to see the condition.
Yeah.
Yes.
As I say in the film, the first time I saw the insides of a state institution was the summer I was a student at George Washington University and went home to Connecticut to intern for a attorney suing the state to close the so-called Mansfield Training School, the place my parents refused to put me in. I wanted to run away as soon as I entered the first back ward we toured. And for those who are not familiar with the term back ward, it's the place where people with multiple significant disabilities and complex needs are consigned. I wanted just to run and never look back. But I saw myself in the eyes of people lying on mats on steel gray concrete. It is not something to turn your back on or ever forget. Soon after I returned to GW, I met two men, Melvin and Cecil, in what was called the Elliott Infirmary at Forest Haven, which had back wards of its own. Melvin and Cecil had cerebral palsy and needed access to AAC like most of those in Elliott. After I graduated from GW, I joined the court-appointed monitoring team overseeing both conditions at Forest Haven and supporting people to move into the community. I focused most of my time over the next 5 years in Elliott, working with others to help about 120 teenagers and adults to, first of all, leave their cage-like cribs, which they spent virtually their entire lives, and to develop the tolerance to use a wheelchair and move into the community. Forest Haven and other spaces like it are now closed. But we must not kid ourselves or allow others to ignore the fact that many, especially those who need AAC, are being locked away in so-called special schools, nursing homes, and intermediate care facilities. Not seen and certainly not heard. History is never neutral. We can leverage it for knowledge and greater justice. Or we can let its worst consequences linger and metastasize.
Ricardo, you submitted a really relevant question for Bob. Do you mind if I read it? It was, who were Harold and Betty Evans? And can you talk about what I call the dream team?
Betty, Harold, and Joy Evans are three of the greatest heroes of the fight for racial and disability justice in our country. And, unfortunately, most people have no idea of who they were, and the enormous debt we owe them and how much we must be paying it forward. The Evans, like many parents, did their best to raise their daughter Joy at home but had to put her into Forest Haven when she was 8 because DC public schools and others throughout the nation barred them from the classroom. Harold and Betty, who I came to love and respect nearly as much as my own parents, never gave up on doing justice by Joy and all others at Forest Haven. Instead, they organized other African American parents to bring a class action lawsuit with Joy as the lead named plaintiff that resulted in closing the institution and replacing it with a system of home and community-based services. I remember Harold telling the story how when serving on the Watergate grand jury, he realized that government corruption had to be exposed, eliminated at all levels. For Betty and him, that meant fighting for simple justice for Joy and the 1,000 others then exiled to Forest Haven. Joy died at the institution shortly after the lawsuit was filed in 1976. But she remained a lead plaintiff, and Betty and Harold remained active, vigilant advocates for freedom until they died 50 years later. That is who the Evans were and why we love them and try to live up to their example. Ricardo, if you would, can you take the second half of the question you just asked me? Please talk about the Dream Team.
Yeah, the Dream Team was a team that I really loved that team. They came together Judy Hillman was hired. Let me check out it right this time. Judy Hillman was hired as the director of Human Services.
Department of Disability Services.
I'm sorry, Department of Disability Services. You know, when I talk about Judy, I always get excited. So just bear with me, I do get excited. Because the work I saw her do when she came was just amazing. She came with some experience, but not a lot of experience.
Yeah.
And she brought Bob on, who came as an advisor. And then she had Laura Ness, who came on, who was on the outside, coming in to see our system and how we can get our system better. And there were quite a few, and they had Rebecca and the attorney, I can't remember her name. It was a good team that came together, and what they were, their goal was to try to fix the system and try to get people to communicate more together and not against one another, and give opportunities like employment. So many people wanted to work, and we needed some work in there on how to get that up and running, that everyone would have an opportunity to get a job if he or she wants a job. I call them the dream team because they really was the team that really made a difference in my life. And they came to Project Action advocacy meetings, and they talked to advocates. They talked to people with disabilities who actually lived in the homes and what's really happening, and what, you know, what can we do to make things better? Testifying at the city council, all of these pieces made a big difference in my life, in our lives. Right, Bob?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, right down.
Ricardo, I think, did you also want to recognize the work of Tony Records and Vince Cray?
Yeah. Oh. So do you want to do it, Donna? Oh. So Tony Record, who is Vince Cray? He was a coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, he's the coach.
Yeah.
He's the coach of getting people to go out and work in the community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was also an advocate, a strong advocate, leader for a lot of us when we had to go down to testify at the city council when our budget gets cut. We think we have a budget for the full year, and we come to find out that a budget is cut, and we have to find out where we're going to get money. So Vince was very motivating in getting us together, but not just us, but providers. Now you have a coalition now of providers coming together, which we never had. You have Project Action Advocacy coming together. You have a Family Advisory Committee coming together, which that's never happened. I mean, people were coming together to make a difference in the lives of all of us with disabilities.
And working on our side in the community with people, you know, in like McDonald's, DC Generals and stuff like that, they couldn't believe that we can do the work, you know. They were shocked, you know, we can hold a job like that. You know, they couldn't believe that we can hold a good job like that. You know, some people was part-time and some people, you know, they were full-time, like Red Top and me. We can hold a job like that. And they were shocked, you know, we can hold a job like that.
And I'm still working at the Martin Luther King Library.
Still work at Martha Luther King Library.
I think you got that award. I'm shocked.
You know.
Yes, I'm still at the library. I'm going on my 47th year there, but I got the job through special ed training. Yeah. I'm trying to send a message to the children who are coming up today because of your label of your disability does not hold you. It does not define you, nor does it hold you back. You could still get the job if you want, and you give it your best. Yeah. And I'm just trying to get that label and help them to understand that.
Yeah. But anyway, we're trying to get people on the outside to hire people with disability in the community, you know, in the community to work, you know, work in these stores and stuff, and they can, you know, like the White House and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Bob, that's the Coca-Cola. That's not me, Bob. She had a Coca-Cola for lunch.
But that's all right. That's all right. You know,
I'm sorry.
Is what I want, you know. This is what I'm speaking of.
Donna, what do you most want people to know about the life and family the two of you made for yourself, Ricky, and his family?
What do you want people to know about you, the life you made for your family?
Yeah, my family. I will tell you about my family. I have a son who was 2 pounds, 11 ounces when he was born. I had him at DC. I had him in Washington Hospital Center. And he was 2 pounds, 11 ounces. And Ricardo Thornton, my husband, he was at basketball. He was playing basketball while I was in labor.
No, I was there with you. Wait a minute, let's clear that up now. I was with you.
He was at the basketball. Playing basketball, and they had to call him and tell him to come to the hospital.
And I came there to see and I was a beautiful 2 pounds, 11 ounce baby boy born on the day that I did have a basketball game. You know what we was playing? We were playing ARC, this great old team.
Yeah.
So I had to make some adjustments on being a parent and what a parent's responsibility was. And it took some while for me to get there. And when I got there, because Ricky has now, up to date him now, he's now graduated from high school.
Yeah.
He's a what, married man?
Huh?
Ricky is married.
He's married. Yeah. He got three children. One is autism. And my two little girls, I was there when they were born. One was Leah, the first one, and the other one is Leah. Leah and Maria. And Daniel is the oldest. But Daniel, you know, Daniel got autism, and he's working now. He graduated. And Leah and Maria, they go to school, and they're doing very good in school.
And the wife and Ricky are very happy.
My son, he's working now. He goes to he worked downtown by the Capitol. He's working in the downtown in the Capitol.
Yeah.
In the Capitol now.
Yeah. Hey,
he's 39 years.
You both have told your story to millions of people, including on 60 Minutes and the movie Profoundly Normal.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think it is important for us to tell our stories, especially to other people with disabilities?
The reason why I think we should tell our stories is because
we want everybody to know our story, and we want to know the people we want to tell them about our story,
We want to grow. Well, when we wanted to get married, we were denied the right of getting married.
Married.
When she proposed to me, mm-hmm. She thought I was a Princeton, you know. But she didn't, we went and talked to our case manager about it, and they thought it was really something that they were not for. Yeah. It was too early. And we're rushing into this thing. And it was just so much negativeness about people with disabilities all over the world that we said, we're going to go get married. We're going to invite people to come out and see Wait a minute. I'm going to let you go. I'm going to leave you flow. Let me finish my line first. You got that Coca-Cola. Don't drink no more soda. I'm just kidding. We wanted to get married. We had asked our case manager. Everybody was against it. But we went on and we talked to people that believed in me.
Yeah.
And we did have a marriage. We had a wedding. We invited people to come to the wedding. Yeah. It was a handicapped wedding. It was people that were in the wedding that with disabilities who came out, and they were very happy. But they had never experienced that. It was a beautiful, beautiful wedding. But we got the photographer. We got someone from 60 Minutes who wanted to do a story, which Bob is right. Mike Wallace, many of you may know him. He came out, did a couple of interviews with me and Donna.
Yeah.
Right?
Hi.
And that's how our story got told into the community. Having the baby, as Donna talked about, there was one piece in there that I really like, and I always talk about, Bob, and that is to remember Donna had a baby when she asked the doctor, will my baby love me? It was a very important key. Will my baby love me? Just pause and think about that. We're overcoming our disabilities. We're getting ready to be new parents. We don't have full experience, but we have people like Georgetown and those people that can give us that resource to need to get us through that process, right? And now Ricky has been successful. So basically what I'm saying is my story, hopefully, is to help somebody. Okay, yes, ma'am. Our story is, we do this a lot. I was only here to help somebody along the way. It's not to hurt anybody, it's just to let you know that there is help out there if you really want it. So the stories are very, very important. Tell your story. Please tell your story.
Yeah.
Right, Donna?
Yes. Yes.
And one more.
As I said at the start, it is now my pleasure to introduce Rebecca Salon, an indispensable friend and colleague to Donna, Ricardo, myself, and many others in DC and the nation. She started her career in New York supporting people leave places like Willowbrook to create new leaves and communities where they belonged. Rebecca, you and I were introduced to each other by our late, great friend, Hank Bersani, in the early 80s. Soon after you began, you started doing the same work in the District of Columbia. Soon after you began, you started doing the same work in the District of Columbia. Much later, we also went on the same whirlwind tour, D-Force of a Lifetime, working for Judy Heumann when she headed the then brand new DC Department on Disability Services. You know this history, and in your own gentle way, as a friend and ally, continue to help people bend the long arc of the universe toward justice, as Dr. King exhorted us to do. Can Donna, Ricardo, and you describe how Project Action continues to create a new history and a more just life and community for us?
Right now.
So, I know Project Action is a self-advocacy group, and we have a wonderful group committee. We had continued a night school program, and many who were in group homes and stuff got a chance to go to evening classes and participate to get their GED education or whatever it is that they wanted to work on, travel training. But what happened was in the middle of the summer, that year, our budget was cut, and we had to close our doors a lot earlier than we wanted to. We had just established a student union government, and we had some wonderful people ready to take on that task, but we needed some help. So we went to advocacy, Miss, I got the word, advocacy in action. And we sat mm-hmm. down and we spoke with them and told them our story and what was happening. And we were able to get it open, I think, for another year. I think we were able to get some grant money to continue that on for that year. So that's how powerful we were. And then we changed the name to Project Action. So my chair wants to make sure I say we have two co-chairs, two vice chairs, a sergeant at arms, secretary, and I love my advisor. We have some advisors who's been around volunteering their time, not asking for no money, but they're volunteering their time to just keep us on board and keep us doing what we love to do. And our theme is to let our voice be heard. Ain't that right, honey?
Yes. Yes.
Hi, it's Rebecca. I was thinking as Ricardo was answering the question about the importance of storytelling that the adult education program that many people attended was cut, and it was the reason that a lot of small self-advocacy groups and their student government group all came together because they realized they needed strength in numbers. But I also remember that Ricardo testified and explained that he was a new parent and he wanted to be able to read to his son. And he wanted to be able to read prescription bottles and things like that. And I think it was stories like that that really changed people's minds, you know, that this was really important. And this was a really powerful thing for you know, adults who had disabilities and who had not had a good education coming up because they were in the institution. Yeah. So they didn't get the literacy skills and things like that along the way. But I'd forgotten that for a very long time. But I remember you talking about that, and Ricardo, and that was just really incredibly powerful. Yeah. And I also love the fact that their tagline, their slogan is "Let our voices be heard," because I think that's what this is all about. You know, that if you don't have a voice, you don't have rights, you can't exercise your rights. And and Project Action is all about helping people have a voice and be able to tell their story and exercise their right and talk about their unique experiences. And also that, you know, that when people were in the institution, there were very low expectations for what people could accomplish. I mean, Donna and Ricardo just talked about that. I mean, they could dream about coming out and getting married and having jobs. I think Donna also worked for almost 40 years. I mean, you know, that both Donna and Ricardo made enormous contributions to the workforce. Donna was at Walter Reed, is that right? But for all that time, you know, so you know, I think that a lot of people look at people with disabilities and forget that, you know, there's a growth curve for all of us, you know, and that if you have high expectations and you believe people will succeed and learn and grow, they will. I mean, I think that, you know, Ricardo and Donna 30 years ago were not the polished speakers that they are now, and you know, probably never imagined that they would have the life experiences that they end up having, you know, being on 60 Minutes several times, having a movie made about your life. You know, it's just, Ricardo was on a panel with Nelson Mandela, you know, in Johannesburg. You know, what an incredible life, but nobody would have thought that when he was still in the institution, because no one really expected anything. And I love, you know, Bob in the film, you know, where it talks about communication being a human right. I think that we forget that. And it's programs like this that I think remind people of how important that is. Are we up to questions and answers, Bree?
Just about.
Bree.
Thank you. I just want to remind everyone that you can use the Q&A box at the bottom of your screens to ask question, because it's about that time for us to start our Q&As. which will include questions submitted in advance and live questions from attendees. The first question for panelists is, what do you say in response to parent groups who are in favor of institutionalization?
What was the question?
The question is, what do you say in response to parent groups who want to institutionalize their children?
I would say don't do it. Hold off. Don't go too fast. Get you some resource and find out, hear some of the story that we're telling here today to you. Institutions is not the best thing. If you want to hide your children, which we don't want people to be hid because they have a disability, they have abilities. And they, the abilities, you got to find the ability so that they can grow. Education is a key that all parents need to know, and need to know that psychologists don't have all the answers to what a disability is. That's something that you have to go and do research around, and you'll find a gift that they have within. And you'll be like, I never known that they can do that. So don't be so fast to look at an institution. Institutions are wonderful for people who may like that kind of stuff, but we should not have to live like that. You didn't do a crime, you know, shouldn't be doing time. You should be living in a community where you're free and you're learning new skills and you're developing each and every day something new. And don't be ashamed of your children because they have a disability. Be proud of them because they have a gift inside. You just got to find it. That's right, honey.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that? Do you think parents should have their children go to institutions?
No. Children disability should not go to institution. No. No.
Mm-hmm.
Many parents and
you and
siblings act out of fear. We had families of people at Forest Haven. Opposed its closing, but so came around when So. How much there loved one grew when they moved to the community. Many parents and siblings act out of fear. We had families of people at Forest Haven who opposed its closing, but some came around when they saw how much their loved one grew when they moved to the community.
I wanted to ask a question of Ricardo and Donna and tell a little story. The question is to ask maybe if you would talk about some of the things that Project Action has done to help people find their voice and to practice, the Toastmasters and the role plays and the things like that. If you could describe some of those things. And while you're thinking about all the things that you want to add to that answer, Bob mentioned that I worked to take people out of Willowbrook and actually Letchworth Village, another New York State institution, in the mid-70s to the very beginning of the 80s. And I remember distinctly my first year, and I was very young at the time to be doing this, but I am no longer very young. But I remember one man in particular who came out of the institution, and he didn't have a way to communicate and seemed very, kind of dull looking, wasn't engaged with his environment. And they were required under that court order to do psychological testing, IQ testing. And on the part of the IQ test that funds what you've learned over time, the general fund of knowledge, he did awful because no one had ever educated him. On the abstract reasoning part, he scored superior intelligence. And so he came out of the institution, and we found out that he had a significant hearing loss, that he needed glasses, hence the fact that he didn't look like he was connecting with his environment was that he couldn't see without correction. And within a very short amount of time, we got at the time, all they had was IBM Selectric typewriters. That was what Bob said that he had used. We got him a typewriter, and within a short amount of time, he found a way to communicate. I mean, his life was so different because he was in a different environment. No one expected anything of him. And it wasn't that we were miracle workers. I mean, it was just, that we were able to help him find a way to communicate, to be able to hear some, to be able to see. And it was just heartbreaking because he was probably in his mid-20s at that point and had been in the institution most of that time. But finding ways for people to communicate is so important. And I know in Project Action, so many people are very shy and need a lot of encouragement. Can you guys talk about, the kinds of things that you do during meetings to
Yeah,
help?
we have we usually have sometimes we have icebreakers at some meetings. We do introductions where each person get to say their name. We don't like people stepping in for them. We like for them to say it, to express themselves. We also have had workshops, conference, where we invited people to come out and to be a part of the conference. And we had the beginning advocacy. And we had something my favorite, one of my favorites is role play, where that's another way that you can communicate. And we have actors that love to do role plays, but it's also educational, and you can see growth in that.
So
Like
the at every one of their meetings, they make sure that everyone has a chance to speak. And just they get applauded for whatever their contribution is. And it really means a lot because no one's ever recognized them in those ways.
Everyone.
I think Bob wanted to add something to that. Bob has come to many, many Project Action meetings.
Yes.
Also.
Here's a plan. Shirley. I have been me the car.
Oh, wait. No, I think she was waiting for you to be done, Bob.
Everyone also listens.
It's true.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry, Donnie, you wanted to talk about Shirley?
So you want to talk about Shirley?
Yeah, well, we get me, Ricardo, and some others, and Lindsay and them. We used to have a role play. We used to do some plays. We used to go out and do some plays on different characters. Me, Ricardo, Lindsay, and some other people.
Players Unlimited. Yeah, Players Unlimited Theater.
The Players Unlimited.
And you was our star.
Huh?
And you was our star.
Yeah, I was the star. And
what happened to your husband? Don't get nothing, never mind.
But anyway, I used to love to do
Take your time, plays.
The plays with Shirley.
Plays and stuff.
Yeah.
Shirley Reese and them. I used to like doing that.
Yeah, and that's another great way to help people find their voice and get some confidence. And we had for a while, several years, a Toastmasters group, which was unlike any traditional Toastmasters group. And we didn't have people checking grammar or we did in many Toastmasters groups that have to cut people off. And there we would celebrate if people, you know, made it 2 minutes. But it was an opportunity, a safe place to be able to practice.
And Bob, just real quick, I want to just say, I mentioned just a little bit about Forest Haven. I meant to tell you in my opening, Mama, the cottages that were out at the institution were named after trees. The oak tree, we had an oak cottage, a maple tree, we had a maple cottage. We had a camellia tree. So some of the trees were, they had names down in the buildings were named after.
Jones Hall.
It doesn't ease the pain that we had to go through down there, but it's just, you need to hear that they had a little bit of the forest around them.
Right.
Thank you, Ricardo. Panelists, would you like to add anything else or share anything else before we move on? All right. To you, Bob.
What?
Ricardo, I have to ask you one last question. I recently heard your brother was trash-talking you about beating you on the basketball court. And William is a real straight shooter. So my question is, do you think you will ever get your game back?
Oh, yeah. he's pretty good. I think I'm gonna get it back. I think Donna said I still got it.
Wow.
Basketball.
No. He got a lot of work to do.
Donna. Yeah. Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow, that was a hard hit, Bob. Ooh.
I'm laughing.
As we draw to a close, I'd like to say to our panelists, thank you for such an informative chat. To attendees, thank you for engaging with us and commemorating 33 years of Forest Haven's closure. Today's webinar was free and open to the public. Our generous supporters enable us to produce programming like this and to keep fighting for communication access and equity. This month, we are celebrating our milestone 5th birthday and welcome celebratory donations. We especially encourage you to sign up for a monthly recurring donation at an amount that works for you. You can also support our important work by signing up for our newsletter and following us on social media. Finally, we'd like to thank again the folks who made the See Us, Hear Us film about Bob possible: School Talk, Humanities DC, and the District of Columbia Developmental Disabilities Council. And thanks so much again to today's captioner, Michelle, and ASL interpreters, Cheryl and Sylvie. That's a wrap.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.